Welcome to Transmission Podcast. I'm your host, Cecilia Lynn Jacobs. For the next little while, we invite you to speculate on the possibility of life on Proxima b, the closest known planet outside of our solar system that has the potential to support life. In each episode, we question what would happen if we suddenly knew we were no longer alone in the universe, and what that would mean for humanity to become an interstellar civilization. Please, stay close.
The one thing I learned over the years is that nature is much more imaginative than we are. We tend to think highly of ourselves, and we tend to be arrogant, thinking that we can predict what nature is about. But as far as I can tell, the most exciting things that we discover are things that we have never imagined. I should also point out in this context that very often physicists do experiments, for example, the Large Hadron Collider. You collide two beams of particles, and you sort of expect to detect the outcome. You have a huge amount of noise and signal there, but you are looking just for what you are expecting. And that's very dangerous. If you are restricting your attention only to things that you are expecting, you will never discover something completely out of the box.
That's Avi Loeb, a Harvard astrophysicist and an advocate for imagination. It's important to keep his advice in mind for today's episode. We're talking about how we would organize ourselves if we were to discover something completely outside the box, the presence of an extraterrestrial civilization. Cecilia Lynn Jacobs. Space is a noisy place. And we receive signals all the time. Everything from energetic waves on the electromagnetic spectrum to the sounds of gravitational waves. Oh, if you haven't heard about how we listen to space yet, go back and listen to episode 1. It's easy to dismiss a signal as nothing more than normal space noise, or to get overexcited and confuse normal transmissions with extraterrestrial communications. SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, has a set of protocols for confirming a signal, but there is nothing that requires anyone to follow them. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. First, we have to receive a confirmed signal at all.
I guess the tricky thing with looking for transmissions is the question of the strength of the transmission. If you were transmitting isotropically, like, so if you have, we're sending a signal out in a spherically symmetric way, like how a star shines. It's not actually how if you had a radio transmission, you wouldn't be sending it out in a spherically isotropic way, probably. But if you did, the strength of that transmission decreases as 1 over the distance it goes squared, 1/z², right? So this is just the inverse square law. And so that means it gets fainter really fast.
Really fast.
That's Dr. Beth Biller from the Royal Observatory at the University of Edinburgh. While there are some significant challenges to detecting a transmission, let's speculate. Let's say a signal does get to us. What do we do? Our next step is to confirm that a signal really does come from extraterrestrial intelligence.
So my name is Dr. Duncan Forgan. I'm an astrophysicist / astrobiologist currently based at the University of St. Andrews. The detection process has many stages. First of all, you see something you don't understand. You then have to try and rule out whether it's a problem with your instrument, whether it's a problem with the way you've taken the data and analyzed it, whether it's something man-made. So, for example, we often see signals that look like SETI signals, but actually are produced by terrestrial broadcasts that bounce off something nearby. So, like, a nearby satellite might reflect some of that signal back to the Earth, and it looks like maybe it's something like an extraterrestrial transmission. So you have to go through this process of kind of checking that you've done it right and that you've not just seen a ghost in your apparatus, you've not just seen a bug in your code, and you've not just seen something bounced off a satellite. So you have this process of checking everything.
I think that the public has this idea that these kinds of experiments are run by people dressed in white lab coats for some reason. I'm not sure why I'd wear them. They're not all that attractive. But anyhow, sitting around white lab coats with clipboards in their hands, with earphones on maybe, listening to cosmic static, hoping to hear a radio transmission from the aliens. Well, that would be a really boring job because we listen to 40, these days, it's 40 million channels simultaneously. So that would be 20 million pairs of earphones, and that would definitely mess up your haircut. So we don't do that. They're all listened to by computers.
That's Seth Shostak.
Senior astronomer here at the SETI Institute. That's S-E-T-I, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And we're located in the Silicon Valley of California. And the Institute is interested in life in space. And amongst its many experiments to look for life is at least one to look for intelligent life. And that's the project I'm involved with. So we're trying to eavesdrop on the aliens. I've been doing this for a while. And before that, I was a radio astronomer studying galaxies. But you find signals all the time because, you know, there are telecommunications satellites orbiting the Earth and stuff like that. So if you found a signal, the first thing you would do is check it out as much as you could. And if you checked it out and were still convinced it looked like it was real, you'd probably call up somebody at another installation somewhere and say, hey, you guys check it out, because you probably wouldn't want to announce to the world you'd found ET if you really hadn't. So you'd want to have it checked out. That would be the first thing you'd do.
Gotcha. And how would we go about checking it out? Like, what would we look at? What are we interested in?
Well, I mean, what you're interested in finding out, that signal that these guys are claiming, is it really coming from the sky? Or is it coming from, you know, a local airport or just a satellite that happened to be passing overhead? So you would just tell somebody at another radio observatory, which is to say somebody with another big antenna, and you would say, look, Bob, we know you're busy, but how about aiming your antennas in this direction and look at this part of the radio dial and see if you find the signal too? And if they don't, then you know you've got a problem with your own setup. But if they do, then I think you can feel fairly confident that you're going to be invited to Sweden in the future to collect a big prize.
Clearly, this is a big project. One that requires many brilliant minds who are willing to work together. Anyone who's been involved in a large-scale project before knows that collaborations on that scale come with their own unique set of challenges. We spoke with Aaron Zimmerman about the recently discovered evidence of gravitational waves. This was also a difficult, lengthy, and expensive project. But this kind of project could perhaps serve as a model for the future discovery of alien life and the resulting scientific collaboration.
We're on to the question maybe of how to organize listening. And I think this really depends on how challenging it is to listen. That really sets a lot of things about how you do it and what your standards are for analyzing your data. So these days we are entering into an era of big collaborative science in every aspect of science, at least in physics and astronomy. So to do something totally new like detect gravitational waves, it really requires, you know, $1 billion and 1,000 people working for 2 decades. And that, of course, changes how you finally analyze and present the data at the end of the day, right? You really have a high burden of putting together something very convincing and very clear and doing a lot. Now, of course, individual scientists generally, right, we work hard, we want to present good results, analyze them thoroughly. They need to pass peer review, but also that's not even the driving goal. People don't really these days, I think, put out papers that they don't think are going to pass peer review. Most of the time they put out papers that they have passed their internal standards, and therefore they will pass peer review. But if you're working in a faster field, if you're working in a field where smaller teams can utilize big telescopes or resources or things like that, or even when you don't need big resources, then people can be a little less careful. And they kind of need to be sometimes because they're in a very competitive field, right? If something happens in the universe and both you and I have telescope time that will allow us to investigate this cool event, one of us can't just sit on our hands while the other person does the analysis and produces the results and gets to say, I discovered whatever. So there's sometimes fields can be quite competitive, and then you have to work faster. So that's I guess the answer to the question of, is everyone so careful? I mean, I think everyone tries to be careful, but sometimes you sacrifice thoroughness in order to make sure that you get your ideas out there in a timely manner. The bigger the collaboration, the more people are going to be thorough.
We do have a set of suggested protocols for the discovery of extraterrestrial intelligence. Breakthrough Initiative's Pete Warden summed up the process.
Well, of course, the postulate is that presumably in some time our program or a related one in the next several years discovers a signal. We've done a fair bit of discussion about how we would work that. There is an existing international organization. It's the International Academy of Astronautics SETI working group, of which most researchers that are working on are members of this. We've been using that to coordinate when there's a potential signal. So the first thing that happens is if there's a signal, we communicate to other people on the working group and people that have different instrumentation. So the next step is to look at the potential signal with as many different, you know, radio telescopes, optical telescopes, other instruments that we may have. The first thing is to contact the members of the working group, and then very soon you would contact other institutions and observatories that have capabilities. After that, of course, we have to figure out what the significance of any detection is. The more data you get, the more significant it is. There is a scale, a scientific scale called the RIO scale, that goes from 0 to 10 in terms of the significance, where 0 is not significant. So if we started to get something that was, you know, 3, 4, 5, the next step after getting the data would be to convene some more intensive working groups to try to assess, again, to prove this is a real intelligent signal and how do we expand on looking at it. There hasn't been a lot of discussion about what the organization might look like, but I think in the end it would be a ad hoc organization, probably under the International Academy of Astronautics.
With these suggested protocols in place, we might be able to effectively organize, but will we give up speed for accuracy? Will a discovery like this wait for good science? We'll look deeper into the next steps when we return. Stay close. Welcome back. We're trying to understand how we might organize around the discovery of an extraterrestrial transmission. We know there are loose protocols for confirming the signal, but many factors come into play when thinking about what might happen next. We spoke to Pippa Goldschmidt, who speculated on this complexity.
I think, at least in the first place, astronomers are good, like you said, at sort of coordinating their work sort of around the world. So at least in the first place, it might be something like when you get something like a supernova, a really bright transient source that you really need to capture information on quickly, so that you tell astronomers around the world to just sort of swivel around and look at this object. So I imagine at least sort of on a very basic level, astronomers working at telescopes would be told to sort of focus telescopes on a particular part of the night sky to try and get as much information as possible at the time, so that you'd know when this thing would have been broadcasting, and you'd know where the broadcast was coming from in the night sky, so you get as much information as you could to try and work out, say, maybe what type of planet is being broadcast from, or what type of object. I'm assuming it's planets, but it might not be, you know, what type of object's doing the broadcasting. And then you'd also go back through your archives and look at all the historical information that he has on that part of the sky to try and work out whether he'd been sending you stuff in the past and you'd missed it. So perhaps you'd already received information from this artificial intelligence in the past, but we just hadn't managed to sort of understand what it was. So it's a matter of perhaps doing a little bit of sort of archaeology, if you like, going back through the information that we have. And we have astronomical information now going back like nearly 100 years in some ways. So that would be part of it too. So that's a kind of very basic aspect of it. In terms of the more sort of sociological, how do we organise ourselves? That's a huge question. I mean, I can imagine like governments sort of, falling over themselves or, trying to work out how to respond. And of course, different governments would want to respond in different ways. Different people want to respond in different ways. So that's a big conversation, if you like. That's a big global conversation.
It can be very comforting to rely on ideology. For example, political ideology or religious ideology or even a scientific ideology. But what's also interesting with something like this that would come out is you would have scientists trying to conduct, the research and development required to develop this technology and actually get to space. They would see very quickly that the soft science issues are as hazardous, as fraught with danger as the hard science issues.
That's Phil Searles, an anthropologist who has studied the social impacts of space research. A game-changing event such as the discovery of extraterrestrial life might raise questions about our existing social structures and about how they might need to change.
When you use an enormous amount of resources, you're going to probably be encroaching on other communities and other people's space. You probably have to revamp a launch site or augment it, or maybe even find a new launch site. And there's a good chance that that's going to displace people or make people angry. And so you're gonna have all these different kinds of stakeholders where some people are going to want it for different reasons, and some people are gonna try to stop it. And then you have the impact of things like social media, where people are going to politicize because it's something that would cost billions and billions of dollars.
And speaking of different groups with different priorities, York University's Catherine Denning pulls all of these groups together into the big question. Who exactly is the we we're referring to anyway?
I think the answer to that depends on who we is. If we're talking about the scientists, so the astronomical community involved in actually listening to and receiving the broadcasts, they would be coordinating between different radio astronomy observatories in order to make sure that they were getting the best quality signal coming in, and also just ensuring that the detection, the reception wasn't subject to all the different problems that you run into in observational astronomy. There are plenty of them. So they would be coordinating between different bases, say, Parkes in Australia, say probably FAST in China, say Arecibo, the Hat Creek Observatory that the SETI Institute runs, all the different observatories, Green Bank, certainly in West Virginia, they would, in facilities in Argentina, everywhere, they would all be coordinating to make sure that they had as much duplication and redundancy in receiving the signal as possible. So that would be well handled from the formal scientific community side. I think what might be very interesting as well, though, is if the signals were going on for any length of time, you might see a lot of private interest in either buying radio telescope time or even perhaps building some new ones in order to have an additional stream coming in. So it's all down to the who is we, because I think we've got a lot of different interests in space now. There's the kind of the standard civilian astronomy community. There is some overlap in anything to do with space with military interests, and there's more and more private interests in space. So but I think also if the signal was significant strength, you'd have pretty well everybody who had any kind of dish of any kind that could potentially receive the signal training it on the skies.
Even without a confirmed transmission, the scientific community is divided. Should we make contact ourselves? Is it too risky? At least one person we spoke with, Dr. Joel Myers at the Canadian Institute for Theoretical Astrophysics at the University of Toronto, thinks that it would be worth it.
So in the event that we were able to listen first, there is some advantage to taking our time, especially given that there is a lag in any communication with a civilization that's 4 light-years away. It doesn't matter that we don't respond within the first year. Our message will take 4 years to get there, whether we send it today or whether we send it 1 year from now. So I think there's some advantage in being able to assess the situation for some time before reaching out. In the longer term, I would hope that we would would take as much information as we could from the signals that, that we were receiving. And I'm cautiously optimistic that there is a way to begin communication at that point. And I do think it would be useful to take advantage of the opportunity to exchange information. It becomes a much more fruitful endeavor, no matter what you hope the long-term payoff is, if it's a two-way street rather than just us listening. So on the whole, I would say, despite the risk of the possibility that they are in fact hostile, the potential reward for a two-way conversation makes it worthwhile to reach out.
Well, I think that, of course, you don't really get to to define what's going to happen next, because we've had some false alarms and we know what happens in the beginning. And what happens in the beginning is that the media go completely bonkers and start calling you up, and you're just totally swamped with your phone melting down on your desk because they want to write about the story.
That's Seth Shostak again, senior SETI scientist.
What you would know at that point is, well, there's somebody out there who can build a transmitter. That's basically all you'd know. But very quickly, by doing some fairly simple experiments, you could figure out, you know, where it was coming from rather precisely. And so then you would train an ordinary telescope, you know, a mirror telescope, if you will, on that spot on the sky and see if you could find a star, and maybe even a star with a planet, if you could find the planet. I mean, you'd want to know how far away is this signal coming from and in which direction, and is there a planet there? At that point, I think that the public would be saying two things. They'd say, well, what are they saying? And secondly, are we going to talk back? Now, let me take that second one first. Talking back, I think that's hard to stop. Some people are going to want to talk back, and they'll just try and do it. But, you know, the aliens might be hundreds of light years away, which means if you talk back and say, hey, we're the Earthlings, we've heard you, and we'd really love to get together, and can we have a party sometime? It might take hundreds of years for that signal to get there, and if they even hear it, then it would take another couple hundred years for them to, you know, respond back to you. So that's a long experiment. I think that the more interesting thing would be, well, what are they saying? And to actually know that, you have to be able to pick up the message. And that's technically very difficult. It would require a very, very, very much bigger antenna, 10,000 times bigger than perhaps what you have. And so that's a big, expensive project, and that would take years to do. But I think that the interest would be there. I mean, you know, we're willing to spend billions of dollars on building walls. I think we could spend, you know, a few billion dollars building a big antenna, because it might cost that amount to actually get the message. And then you'd have to try and understand the message, which, of course, might or might not ever succeed. I mean, you know, they might be so far advanced that you just don't understand the message.
What do you think? Would you want to reach out? Would you want your tax dollars put to work building a giant antenna or investing in a translation project that might never succeed? This has been Transmission Podcast, hosted by Cecilia Lynn Jacobs and produced by Ian Garrett and Kate Ladenheim. With special thanks to today's guests,
Aaron Zimmerman,
Pippa Goldschmidt,
Seth Diller,
Dr. Duncan Forgan,
Seth Shostak,
Phil Searles,
Catherine Denning,
Avi Loeb,
Pete Warden,
Joel Myers.
Original composition and sound editing by Miles Avery. Transmission is a podcast and performance series speculating on what might happen if we began to receive the popular broadcasts of intelligent alien life, and follows two sisters selected to lead an interstellar mission to make first contact. Learn more about our team and upcoming performances at luxeterra.com and find us on Facebook and Twitter at Luxeterra. That's LuxeTerra. Transmission is a production of Toaster Lab in Canada and is a fiscally sponsored project of Fractured Atlas in the United States.